In 12 years of doing this, I have become accustomed to God pre-planning my sermons for events and developments that I could never have predicted, and fitting things together in all sorts of intricate and marvelous ways. And on the basis of that, I am forced to conclude that he's done it again, albeit in a rather different sort of way than normal. I can honestly say in 12 years, I've never gotten into the pulpit feeling like I got nothing, but this is really about as close as I have ever come. You know, even as absent-minded as I can be, most Sundays I would notice that that was Isaiah 52 in the assurance of pardon, not Romans 5, especially since it was there for a reason. That's, of course, the passage immediately before what the eunuch is reading in Philip's encounter in Acts. And in particular, this is not one of those days when talking about joy comes easily and naturally for me. As I think most of you probably know by now, the last couple of days didn't exactly go according to plan. We had a presbytery meeting this past Friday, which was down in South Charleston, Ohio, which is a small town between Dayton and Columbus, which is chiefly notable for being between Dayton and Columbus. But it does have a rather large EPC congregation. Yeah, and so they were hosting, about 3.5 hours away. And I'd sort of been hoping I could, you know, catch a ride down with the folks who were going down from the downtown church. But, you know, they had, you know, truck. It was the sort of thing, I mean, you can squeeze, you know, five in if you don't mind being really uncomfortable in the middle back. And, you know, Jim Reisler, who was driving, really didn't want to do that. So I said, okay, fine, I understand. So we drove down, and everything went fine until, you know, I came to the exit off of I-70 onto Ohio 41, which is the road that runs down into South Charleston. I came off, you know, pulled up to the stop sign, came to a stop, and heard clunk. And when I started driving again, well, I didn't start. I pushed down the gas and it just went roar. It thought it was in neutral. So I tried bringing it down into third. That didn't happen. Second, it would sort of go. Really, what I found through a little bit of trial and error is that the only way I was really going to get that thing moving from a stop was in first gear. It didn't take me very long driving along a state highway in first gear to decide I better try something. Yeah, better I pull off and I get rear-ended. So I moved up into second, and that went fine. You know, so a little bit more speed, and then I thought, well, you know, maybe this is really courting disaster here, but it would be nice to be able to get closer to the speed limit. So I moved up into third, and that went fine. And then at that point, figured, yeah, let's go for it. You know, push it all the way up into fourth. No problems. So it's going along, and I'm starting to hope that, you know, somehow maybe it was just a random thing. But no, there's, you know, came to the stoplight, and, you know, light turns green, hit the gas, same deal over again. Fortunately, it was only about half a block into the church. Unfortunately, I had a semi bearing down on me from behind. But I managed to stay in front of him. God was good. Yeah, I mean, in effect, out of all of this, you know, my automatic transmission had decided to become a stick shift, which would be fine since there's no clutch. So, pull in, you know, wander into the church looking a little bit shell-shocked, start asking for help. Turns out there's not any place in South Charleston that does auto repair. He said, the guy we used to have who did that died a couple of years ago. You know, that's a small town, right? You ask how to go somewhere and they start giving you directions based on that used to be there 5 years ago, that was there 10 years ago, that sort of deal. But, you know, there were towns, larger towns, not too far away, that could do that. I ended up having it towed to Springfield, which is about 12 miles away. And they looked it over, and told me that they thought they could probably have it fixed by Wednesday. Now, obviously, I had some place to be this morning. So I wasn't just going to stick around. I managed ultimately to hitch a ride back with the folks from Warsaw EPC. Yeah, I mean, 3 hours, you know, in the jump seat in the middle back was a lot better than spending the night in Ohio. Nothing against Ohio, but it wasn't where I needed to be. And yeah, I'm not sure how I'll get back down there either. But I presume by God's grace, we'll figure something out. He's provided this far, he'll provide the rest of the way. Now, you can imagine, out of all of this, I only had about half my mind free for the presbytery meeting. I was sort of fully in at some points, and at other points I wasn't even in the room. And I got to the end of the service. This is, you know, the last service of the year, last assembly of the year, so there's always closing communion service that's celebrated by the outgoing moderator, in this case, the Reverend Doug Walker. And I was in and out, mentally and literally. I was still trying to figure out how I was going to get home at that point, or even if I was going to make it home that night. But at one point, you know, during the sermon, I think the Spirit nudged me a little bit. And I started thinking really how ironic it was that all this was happening, you know, and I was supposed to be getting ready to preach about joy. And, you know, the Spirit kind of kept poking me on that, you know, thinking about my circumstances and this sermon and this passage. Because certainly I did not, at that point, feel anything remotely resembling joyful. Stressed and unhappy would be a better descriptor. And it's not like it just magically went away either. You know, made it home, you know, the adrenaline goes completely away. Yeah, the crash left me feeling pretty rotten Saturday morning, pretty disoriented. But God reminded me as I was sitting there in the service, and he reminded me again Saturday afternoon, and drawing me out of, you know, the funk I was in at that point, that there's more to the story than my circumstances. That joy doesn't come from our circumstances. It comes from the presence and work of God amidst our circumstances. Which, of course, I'm a preacher, I went to seminary, I've said all this lots. When you really have to say it to yourself, it gets a little bit harder. But it is true. And as it began to sink in the other night and yesterday afternoon, and is kind of settling back in on me even now, it does help. It is the presence of the blessing of God. And it is a gift to be able to remember and to be able to know that God is in control when my transmission breaks. And he's working for my good when I don't know how I'm going to get home. Just as much as if I'd driven down and back without anything going wrong. That's not how we tend to think of the blessing of God. We tend to think God is blessing us when things go well, and when things go badly, he's not, and then we ask that he'll start blessing us again so we can deal with it. When in actual fact, God sometimes has kind of a strange idea of blessing. And whatever he sends us is in some way something that he is working in to bless us and to enable us to find his joy. Because joy is not in what the world can give. Joy is in the Lord. And this is very evident, though not necessarily obviously so, you know, in our culture. But it's very evident in the life of this traveler that Philip meets in Acts 8. And there's a couple things that, you know, you need to know about him. First off, even more than you might have guessed, this is a rich and a powerful man. In that day and age, Most people, when they traveled, they walked. With those who were better off, had a donkey. Maybe if they were doing really well, they had two. The rich could afford a horse. This Ethiopian is in a chariot. Very, very small percentage of people who could do that. And that might seem a little bit odd to us when we think of Ethiopia. I think for most people, probably the mental images, you know, go back to, you know, the times of, you know, famine and civil war in recent decades. We don't think of Ethiopia as being a rich country. But at that point in time, it was. For some odd reasons, cultures and civilizations and governments developed very strangely, but this is really one of the odder ones. You see, Ethiopia was a kingdom where the king didn't do anything. According to their religion, he was the child of the sun god, and so he was too holy, far too holy, to do anything like work, let alone all that complicated and difficult and nasty work of actually ruling anything. The actual ruler was the Queen Mother, which, this must have been an interesting system for the women, don't you think? I mean, put yourself in this position. You marry the king, and all of a sudden, you have a husband who not only doesn't do any work, that might not be unfamiliar to you, but in fact is not allowed to do any work at all, whatsoever. I mean, not even so much as changing the toilet paper. While, as you're dealing with a husband who does nothing, your mother-in-law runs not just your life, again, maybe not unfamiliar, but everybody else's. Your job is to have a son whom everyone will pretend to believe isn't your husband's, which I suppose means he doesn't have to be your husband's. And then, assuming you have a son, when your mother-in-law dies, you take over the country. What a way to run a railroad, huh? Well, the Queen Mother was called the Kandake, which has been anglicized into Candace, and her officials were all eunuchs, probably to make sure that no one beat the sun god to the punch in the whole production of an heir thing. And it probably shouldn't surprise us that it was a rich and powerful kingdom, because the one good thing about the way their system operated, they didn't really have to depend on anything as fickle as inheritance to provide them with good rulers. The Queen Mother ran everything. She picked the wife for her son. So she, knowing what all went into running the country, presumably could go out and identify somebody who would be a good successor and train her daughter-in-law upright so that things would continue to run smoothly while the useless king just sort of puttered around in the background. Obviously, there's any kingdom, there's a lot that needs to be done. Well, who are the ones around the Queen Mother? Besides the daughter-in-law in training, you have the eunuchs. They were the executive branch, they were the government. And since this particular official was in charge of the royal treasury, he was right at the top of the food chain. Wouldn't seem to be someone who needed much of anything at all. And yet, here we find him out on a road in the middle of the desert. He has everything. He's looking for something more. Jerusalem was a long way from the capital of Ethiopia, which, just to confuse you, was located in what we now call Sudan. So it's a long, hot, dry trip. And then, having made that trip up to Jerusalem, because he's a Gentile, when he gets to the temple, he can't go any further than the outermost court. You know, even the women among the Jews got to go closer to the presence of God. He's stuck in the outside. And what's more, unlike most Gentiles, who could, if they really wanted to, break out of that restriction by converting, becoming Jews, accepting circumcision, he didn't have that option because he was a eunuch. Deuteronomy 23:1 barred him forever from the temple. It was a long, arduous trip to go somewhere that he knew in advance he would be told he wasn't welcome. And he made it anyway. And not only that, he'd gone to the considerable additional effort to acquire a scroll of Isaiah. This was a man who was determined to worship God whether God wanted him or not. And then suddenly, as he's riding through the desert on his way back from Jerusalem, God sends him a message on two legs. Yes, I want you. Just as he's coming to something that he cannot understand, Philip is out there waiting for him. And he tells him exactly who the prophet is talking about, and it's something that he needs to understand. This is what he's been looking for. And so as they're riding together, the road crosses a stream, and he asks to be baptized. And Philip baptized him, and then the Spirit of the Lord took Philip away. And do you notice something? The eunuch doesn't care. In a sense, he owes Philip everything, but he doesn't care. He went on his way rejoicing because he didn't need Philip anymore. He'd been looking for something all his wealth and power couldn't give him. And now he had been found. And he rejoiced. He exulted in the goodness of God. You know, he had experienced the promise of Isaiah. Water in the desert and streams of life in the wilderness. The great Reformed Baptist preacher, Charles Spurgeon, still known by many as the Prince of Preachers, had a somewhat similar story. As a young man growing up in England, he wanted desperately to know how to be saved. And he tells in his autobiography how he searched in vain, going from church to church to church and getting all kinds of things that were all very good but didn't tell him how to have his sins forgiven. Until one Sunday, as he was on his way to one church, a snowstorm bottled him up and diverted him down an alley into a little tiny church. He says about 15 or 20 people. And he wrote this. He said, "The minister did not come that morning. He was snowed up, I suppose. At last, a very thin-looking man, a shoemaker or tailor or something of that sort, went up into the pulpit to preach. Now, it is well that preachers should be instructed, but this man was really stupid. He was obliged to stick to his text for the simple reason that he had little else to say. The text was, 'Look unto me and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth.' The preacher began thus, 'My dear friends, this is a very simple text indeed. It says, look. Now, look and don't take a deal of pains. It ain't lifting your foot or your finger. It is just look. Well, a man needn't go to college to learn to look. You may be the biggest fool, and yet you can look. Anyone can look. Even a child can look. But then the text says, look unto me. Many on you are looking to yourselves, but it's no use looking there. You'll never find any comfort in yourselves. Some look to God the Father. No, look to him by and by. Jesus Christ says, look unto me. Some on you say, we must wait for the Spirit's working. You have no business with that just now. Look to Christ. The text says, look unto me. When he had managed to spin out 10 minutes or so, he was at the end of his tether. Spurgeon continues. Then he looked at me under the gallery, and I dare say, with so few present, he knew me to be a stranger. Just fixing his eyes on me as if he knew all my heart, he said, "Young man, you look very miserable." Well, I did. But I had not been accustomed to have remarks made from the pulpit on my personal appearance before. However, it was a good blow, struck right home. He continued, "And you always will be miserable, miserable in life and miserable in death, if you don't obey my text. But if you obey now, this moment, you will be saved." And then lifting up his hands, he shouted, "Young man, look to Jesus Christ. Look, look, look. You have nothing to do but to look and live." I saw at once the way of salvation. I had been waiting to do 50 things. When I heard that word, "look," what a charming word it seemed to me. Oh, I looked until I could almost have looked my eyes away. There and then, the cloud was gone. The darkness had rolled away. And at that moment, I saw the sun. That's how it is. No matter how dark the clouds may be, no matter how dry the desert, if we will look to the Lord, we find his living water, and we find joy. Even in the darkest and most barren place, we find his joy and we see his light. Because he's good. And in the end, that's all that matters. Let's pray.